to John Gorman, whom I've become very acquainted with, closely acquainted with, serving on the Art Commission of Galveston for the past year and a half. And I have found him to be a very witty and clever man, and enjoyed the experience of getting to know him. John was born in Chicago and raised in Aurora, Illinois, and came to Texas in 1974 after completing his studies at Notre Dame and University of Virginia. He and his wife, Margaret Doran, live in Galveston, and they have two grown daughters. He's been a poet since his very early days in his mid-20s. He now teaches at University of Houston, Clear Lake, and is a professor of literature. The literary magazine Biosphere grew out of his early classes. He has directed the monthly Poets Roundtable that works in Galveston, and he served on the board of the independent magazine Edgar. He is a regular First Friday, Houston's longest-running reading series. He's been a juried poet, a guest poet, a judge and workshop leader. And one of his poems, A Mayan Hand, was paired with the artwork by the same name at the in a program, poetry program at the Museum of Fine Arts. His work has appeared in more than two dozen Texas publications, with more nationally and in Canada. His work is in the forthcoming new anthology of Texas Beat Poets. He's also featured in recent anthologies in Houston, Texas Poetry and Poems, on spiritual themes in a secular world. In November 2006, he did a two-poet show at the Galveston 1894 Opera House in Galveston, and was part of the one-year remembrance of Hurricane Ike. So I'd like to welcome John with his program. Gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, but apparent of the others. When a poem is almost a prayer, gratitude when a poem is almost a prayer. Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. I was going to say that I'm going to present 10 poems, so those of you who wonder when it's going to be over can count them down. And I was going to say that between poems, I would welcome comments or discussion, but then I heard Tony. So I don't know. But if you just can't resist, you know, by all means raise your hand. That my answers to the questions that the Thoreauvians asked Tony are yes, I don't know, yes, and sure. Okay. There's going to be a musical interlude in a second. I'm extremely pleased with myself, as I was telling Bunny, to be doing a multimedia presentation in this small way. And at a couple of places, not every single poem, I'm going to talk a little bit about poetry itself and why I think that it's a wonderful medium for carrying the theme of gratitude. That just a couple of initial comments, that it's language that's been compressed for impact and made more musical. And that my notion is that the impact of something that we feel that makes our response be gratitude is an important kind of existential part of the whole phenomenon, and that the musicality suggests that the universe, when we're feeling grateful for it, is going in a harmonic way. I also did not a definition, but a kind of characterization of gratitude, that it breaks the self-enchantment of the ego. which can be broken in other ways that are less pleasant by fear or by violent force or by despair. But in gratitude, we have a joyful response to an infusion of joy, that something outside of us gets in and its new presence in us makes us better. And so that it's the renovated person who speaks the poem of gratitude. I wanted to start with a short lyric from The Love and Spoonful. I don't know if I have age mates here in the house, but I think I'm going to talk about it a little bit afterwards, but I think it catches a lot of what gratitude is about. Bunny, hit it. That's a little thing that I sing to myself every once in a while over the last 50 years or whatever it's been. But the three ideas. The full measure of your giving, you don't yet understand. That there's always going to be an element of mystery in gratitude. But it's not the mystery of puzzlement. It's the mystery of a fullness that we can't quite comprehend. A cup full of living. You know, I'm thinking of the brilliance of the way the chalice contains light, and then it sends the light out to illuminate us. There's also the sacramental cup in the more liturgical churches, or just the cup of water when you're thirsty. You know that we're nourished by gratitude, and then it's four things. The full weight of your loving makes me lighter than air. It's that weight makes you light. You know that it's paradox, but it's a happy paradox. And that kind of expression, too, I think comes from experiencing a fuller meaning than you can immediately process. And then finally, the tax on receiving. Now I know that it never was there. That it takes us out of the world of account keeping. You did this for me, I'll do that for you. If you do this for me, I'll do that for you. It's unearned, you know. It's just something that comes like lanyap on our lives in the universe. Okay. This is a poem of Shakespeare's. It's Sonnet 29. And it deals with the pre-gratitude situation. So it's got a nice kind of dramatic feel to it. And it's got one of my very favorite lines in all of poetry. So I'll be pleased to recite it. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him, with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy content at least. Yet, and these pivotal points in a poem are always, you know, I'm always going to turn it, and he is. Yet, in these thoughts, myself almost despising, haply I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings. Let me talk about the lark line. which is something I just absolutely admire. The Shakespeare wasn't bad, you know? When he sat down at his writing desk or wherever he did that stuff. And it's one of the ways that the music of poetry works, that like to the lark at break of day, that it gets you a kind of attraction in the line, that the line is describing a bird rising at first light, and so you've got two positive images at once. But then there's this thing that's done with the sound, that like and lark both have those L sounds and they both have K sounds, but the L sound drops out and the K is continued in break, and the long A in break is continued again, and then you have the poem breaks free from that pattern, like the lark rising, and what you have is just a kind of farewell look back at the sound of the R. So here we go. Like that, I'll tell you what. I'll read it. I'll overread it first for teaching purposes, and then I'll read it. I'll read it the correct way as a tribute to Shakespeare. Like to the lark at break of day or rising break day, like lark that. Like to the lark at break of day arising. You know, so beautiful. And really so simple, but with all of that kind of hidden musicality, that hidden craft in it. Comments? Do you want to ask me if I believe in legalizing marijuana? Maybe. Although I must say that the statute of limitations has run out 4 or 5 times. So I'm not really nervous about it being illegal. I want to do a little poem by the American poet Amy Lowell. It's called A Decade, and it's an anniversary poem for a loving relationship. When you came, you were like red wine and honey, and the taste of you burnt my mouth with its sweetness. Now you are like morning bread. I hardly taste you at all, for I know your savor, but I am completely nourished. Isn't that nice? And unlike the two things earlier, it's a free verse poem. And that one of the ways that free verse, when it gives up its reliance on regular rhythm and rhyming patterns, in order to remain a poem, it has to work on its structure and it has to work on its sounds in its own ways. And one of the things that she does is give like 10 years ago and then 10 years ago. And an inventiveness in the imagery, that the red wine and honey, I think, is terrific. You get sweetness, intoxication, you know, the wildness of first love. And then morning bread. You go, uh-oh. You know? And in fact, the poem is a close call. If it went like this, and say that you're coming down to breakfast on the morning of your 10th anniversary, and you find a poem standing by your egg cup, and you think, oh, a poem. And you read it, and it says the red wine and honey part, and then it says, now I hardly taste you at all, for I know your savor. But I am completely nourished. And that's the gratitude, the idea, like in the business of the cup, in the Love and Spoonful song, the cup full of living, that the way that we nurture one another in a loving relationship. And of course, that automatically calls up gratitude unless we're awful people. And awful people don't show up at UU on a Sunday morning. So there we are. Got a poem called Wild Gratitude. And this is by Ed Hirsch, who for years lived in Houston. He was on the faculty at the creative writing program at Central Campus, which has a very strong national reputation. another little literary thing in here, that he's playing with his cat. You know, the poem starts in very ordinary circumstances, and it picks up steam, and suddenly he has a quick understanding that the religious term epiphany was taken over into as a literary term by James Joyce, that a kind of a sudden blazing awareness, that the word in its Greek roots means shining outward, shining through a surface. But let's just run it. Tonight, when I knelt down next to our cat, Zoe, and put my fingers into her clean cat's mouth and rubbed her swollen belly that will never know kittens, and watched her wriggle onto her side, pawing the air, and listened to her solemn little squeaks of delight, I was thinking about the poet Christopher Smart, who wanted to kneel down and pray without ceasing in every one of the splintered London streets, and was locked away in the madhouse at St. Luke's with his sad religious mania and his wild gratitude and his grave prayers for the other lunatics and his great love for his speckled cat, Jeffrey. All day today, August 13th, 1983, I remember how Christopher Smart blessed this same day in August 1759 for its calm bravery and ordinary good conscience. That was the day he blessed the Postmaster General and all conveyancers of letters for their warm humanity, and the gardeners for their private benevolence and intricate knowledge of the language of flowers, and the milkmen for their universal human kindness. This morning I understood that he loved to hear, as I have heard, the soft clink of milk bottles on the rickety stairs in the early morning. And how terrible it must have seemed when even this small pleasure was denied him. But it wasn't until tonight, when I knelt down and slipped my hand into Zoe's waggling mouth, that I remembered how he'd called Jeffrey the servant of the living God in daily serving him. And for the first time understood what it meant, because it wasn't until I saw my own cat whine and roll over on her fluffy back that I realized how gratefully he had watched Jeffrey fetch and carry his wooden cork across the grass in the wet garden, patiently jumping over a high stick, calmly sharpening his claws on the wood pile, rubbing his nose against the nose of another cat, stretching or slowly stalking his traditional enemy, the mouse, a rodent, and this is a quotation from Smart, a creature of great personal valor. And then, dallying so much that his enemy escaped. And only then did I understand it is Jeffrey and every creature like him who can teach us how to praise, purring in their own language, breathing themselves in living fire. The thing I like about that, so I'm going to say, are there any comments? And I'll say yes. the thing that I like about that is how the ordinary can be transfigured by attention, and that we can see the value in everything that has value. That the title of my talk was When a Poem is Almost a Prayer. This next one actually is a prayer. It's Pied Beauty by Jared Manley Hopkins. And that if you know Hopkins' work, his most famous poem is called God's Grandeur. You know that he's a kind of organ master of the language. It just sort of and so this kind of lavishness, this sort of Baroque linguistic overkill, is part of the experience of the richness of the things that he's grateful for. You think, too, of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, that famous How Do I Love Thee? Let me count the ways. And then she counts about 12,000 ways, you know, that she loves Robert Browning. And it's height and breadth and depth and, you know, just like everything, this huge infusion of richness. But again, as in Ed Hirsch's poem, what Hopkins is writing about is a series of ordinary things. Pied Beauty. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brindled cow, for rose molds all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal chestnut falls, finches' wings, landscapes plotted and pierced, food, fallow and plow, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle, dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. In a less ecstatic and less doctrinal way, Hopkins was a Jesuit priest in 19th century England. Kay Boyle, who's a fallen away Catholic in 20th century California, has a wonderful poem about growing up in the Mojave Desert and how objects like pulleys and pumps become, you know, significant in a way that, you know, that comes from their context of sparseness and scarcity, and that you know, that basically we can find our way to love in anything. Okay, time is fleeting. I'm going to skip a poem by Laura Riding, which I like. It's called Because of Clothes. The middle part of it is very difficult, and that it, you know, I could unscramble it. I am a professor of literature, but you know, we don't have time to do it. But let me read its conclusion. Inner is the glow of knowledge, and outer the gloom of appearance. By putting on cloak and cap, with only the hands and the face showing, we turn the gloom in and glow forth softly. Whether by the neutral grace of the needle we possess our wherefore by the neutral grace of the needle we possess our triumphs together with our defeats in a single balanced complement, we pause between sense and foolishness and live. A thing I like about the way she brings that poem to a conclusion is that there's a false opposition, and we tend to think in these false oppositions. You know, it's either good or bad. You're either for me or against me. You're either a progressive or a Tea Party conservative. And sometimes it's true, but that it's in the middle range where the unexpected can happen. It's in the middle range where the creative can happen. And who would think to write a poem about clothes, talking about the inner life and the outer life? And she's actually in praise of clothes because they disguise most of our bodies. And the part that's left is the expressive part, the face, the hands, and then you see the spirit of the person inside. So I didn't exactly skip Laura Riding. I was going to say, I'll read 10 wonderful poems, but this next one is by me, so I didn't say it because I had a sneaking suspicion it would be thought to be arrogant. But this is set in Galveston. It's called Some Live Oaks. I gave it a deliberately kind of low-key title. There's a reference to Sailing to Byzantium and Byzantium, two poems by William Butler Yeats that are about a yearning in the mind to get beyond life with all of its difficulties and all of its messiness. It isn't what Yeats believes finally, but he believes that it's a kind of a state of our encounter with life. So I do a little bit of Byzantium material, hammered gold and gold enameling. He imagines himself coming back as an artificial bird in the court of the Roman Emperor of the East. But I can show you where these trees are. They're on 25th Street. Maybe you can look at them and find them yourselves. Some live oaks. Three blocks closer to the beach, there are none. But here, though stunted, they hold, made like their far cousins, the salt cedars, beautiful in a balance of tribulations. The wind turns what the sun lifts as gravity arcs it all down. It's hard to believe there wasn't a worker, hammered gold and gold enameling, But Byzantium falls, emperor and sultan, the patriarch, shorn of retinue, lives in the diminished splendor of his house, while these confections, satisfying the most sublime intelligence of the eye, whether or not they come by chance, are lavished on us. As we stroll the neighborhood, up to the food king for cigarettes and milk, back from parole counseling, volleyball, church, or running the kids to ballet in the Volvo, they're there, waving their 10,000 Gothic leaves, phoenix feathers, feathers of the rock, everything in them gnarled, intricate, twisted, perfect together, making a vivid splash of our land-anchored life on the air, making a cave of the sky. Thank you. Down to three. This is a wonderful poem, I think, by Gary Soto, a Mexican-American poet out in California, called Looking Around, Believing. And he starts with the image of just moving your feet, you know, that any place and any time we can begin the little journey in the ordinary, or as we sometimes say in English departments when we want to be fancy, the quotidian, the everyday. You begin walking and who knows what you'll find. Because I think a part of gratitude is surprise. That, you know, if we're really expecting the positive thing, when the positive thing comes, we're happy. But it doesn't have the compression, it doesn't have the impact, it doesn't have the musical response, it doesn't have the things that these poets are trying to catch. Gary Soto, looking around, believing. How strange that we can begin at any time. With 2 feet, we get down on the street. With a hand, we undo the rose. With an eye, we lift up the peach tree and hold it up to the wind. White blossoms at our feet. Like today, I started in the yard with my daughter, with my wife, poking a potted geranium. And now I am walking down the street, amazed that the sun is only so high, just over the roof. And a child is singing through a rolled-up newspaper. And a terrier is leaping like a flea at the bakery as I pass. A palm, like a suctioning starfish, is pressed to the window. We're keeping busy this way, that way. We're making shadows where sunlight was, making words where there was only noise in the trees. That the universe becomes intelligible. And it's one of the ways of thinking what we are. You know, that if you take the popular 20th century description of the world as being, you know, material and the changes in it that happen by chance, even if all of that is true, we're still the universe being aware of itself. We're still the universe processing itself, appreciating itself. You know, we become centers of meaning in the allegedly meaningless universe. So we're fixing it up. We're curing it of its possible flaws. This is a poem by Gary Snyder, one of the beat poets of the 1950s. And the one who took the most serious turn of all of them into Zen Buddhism. And he became very interested in other forms of non-Western understanding. That he's the poem is a tribute to a prayer in a Native American prayer in the Mohawk language, a prayer for the great family. Gratitude to Mother Earth, sailing through night and day, and to her soil, rich, rare, and sweet. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to plants, the sun-facing, light-changing leaf and fine root hairs standing still through wind and rain. Their dance is the flowing spiral grain. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to wild beings, our brothers, teaching secrets, freedoms, and ways, who share with us their milk. Self-complete, brave, and aware in our minds, so be it. Gratitude to the sun, blinding, pulsing light through trunks of trees, through mists, warming caves where bears and snakes sleep. He who wakes us in our minds, so be it. Gratitude to the great sky, who holds billions of stars and goes yet beyond that, beyond all powers and thoughts, and yet is within us, grandfather space. The mind is his wife. So be it. I love that idea that, although in terms of simple physics and logic, the small container can't contain the bigger thing. In human experience, that's not necessarily true. You know, that we have this sense of the everything inhabiting us, and we at this kind of, and again, it's paradox, and again, it's happy paradox. It's a form of joy. I'm going to conclude without any commentary except the poem itself after I make an initial comment, with a poem by James Wright called A Blessing. It's set up in Minnesota, and it's the ending of it just kind of blows me away. That I'm thinking of gratitude as a disruptor of systems that would imprison and control us. And this poem contains an image of boundary crossing. He goes out into a field that's been fenced off with barbed wire. But the beauty of the poem wouldn't come without that transgression, without that, you know, that going beyond where he's permitted. A blessing. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bounds softly forth on the grass, and the eyes of these two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture where they have been grazing all day alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. At home, once more, they begin munching the young tufts of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild on her forehead, and the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly, I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom. Thank you.